From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armilla, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk phonotactics. Think you don't know what they are? Oh, yes, you do. You can't help it. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and joining me as they do each week, language experts and New York Times best-selling authors, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Ross. I'm looking forward to just wrapping up our little talk about eponyms that we started last week. And the reason is that I low-kenuinely love eponyms. Have you heard this word?
No, but it's named after someone, isn't it? I'm just guessing.
It is not, actually. It is not. But it is a word that I came across, and it sounds like this is actually a pretty recent word. Usually, I'm coming across these words about 2 years or 5 years into their existence. But this one looks like it came around late 2025, low-kenuinly.
Low-kenuinly.
Can you imagine what this might mean? It might be easier if you saw it written. L-O-W-K-E-N-U-I-N-E-L-Y.
Oh, I know what it means. I just realized it now.
What?
Well, it has low key, I bet.
Uh-huh. Low key and combined with genuinely.
Genuine. So it's like sort of kind of mildly.
Yeah, you're not going overboard in your enthusiasm for it, but you genuinely like it or hate it or whatever it is.
It's a portmanteau.
It is. And it's using this term low key that has become more popular, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, like I low key hate that, or I low key love that. Like, it's not super intense, but right. And so I guess it's gotten really popular on TikTok, but I saw it the other day somewhere or another.
That
and I was like, what in the world is this?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I looked it up on Urban Dictionary, and the earliest entry I could find was from November of last year. So it looks like it's a pretty recent word.
It does. It's in Merriam-Webster now, too. I'm just looking at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're saying, Fletcher, you're right. It emerged on TikTok in late 2025.
You're so modern, Fletcher.
I know. I felt really good about that. Because, like I said, I'm usually not seeing these things for a very long time. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're already on their way out when I learn about them. And maybe this is, too. Who knows? Things move quickly. But low-kenuinely. You know, I'm not 100% sure how I feel about it, just because it seems kind of unwieldy. It seems like... I feel like it's you're kind of twisting yourself in knots a little bit just to say this.
Genuinely.
I don't think it's going to last for that reason.
Oh, no, it's too hard
to say.
Yeah.
Low-kenuinely. I mean, low-kenuinely. It's like,
harder to write, actually, to me, because it's like my fingers don't want to do that. It's like, no, it's wrong. Yeah. You know, it's
stuck. Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought it was fun.
Yeah. Low-kenuinely. It's hard to say, low-kenuinely.
But it's sort of fun to say, low-kenuinely.
Yeah, you know.
Okay.
Well, so last week we were talking about eponyms, things that get their... The word is derived from the name of a person, so we mentioned mausoleum.
Nachos.
Nachos. From a guy named Ignacio. What was his last name? Do you remember?
It was Ignacio Anaya.
Yeah, Nacho. And then mausoleum from a Greek guy named Mausolius.
Mausolus.
That one I missed.
Yes.
So we're going to wrap that up with a few more here at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, we thought we'd finish it off quickly. And we have a number here. And the two right now we have to contrast them is flunky, like a servant, or paparazzi, which is a society photographer.
Right. And you're asking me which one is...
Which one is the eponym? Right.
I think paparazzi. I think doesn't that come from a Fellini movie?
Yep.
Well,
it
was in La Dolce Vita.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that was a person, right? Wasn't it?
Okay. This is sort of a cheat. You're right. It did appear in the film La Dolce Vita by Fellini, but it was already a surname, and he apparently took the name, which he found in an opera libretto. Then another guy says, well, they saw it. They were reading a travel log and they read about the name. And then he threw it into the film. So it's sort of a name, sort of an eponym, sort of
It's kind an eponym. It's just not a real person.
It's, well, it's a modified eponym. Limited.
Modified limited.
Yeah. Okay, the next duo, Galvanize or Gargoyle.
That's funny. So just because I read something doesn't mean it's true. But I think I just read the other day that Gargoyle is actually more like an onomatopoeia, like it comes from the gargle, which is the sound that the water would make coming out of the gargoyle. So I'm going to go with Galvanize. I don't know who Galvan might have been, but that's what I'm going with.
Very good. Yeah, it came from Luigi Galvani.
Galvani. Very good.
Who was a professor of anatomy at Bologna, and he discovered it in the late 1700s when he ran currents through the legs of dead frogs.
Uh-huh. As you do.
They were stimulated. But you're right, gargoyle does come from the French gargouille. How do you pronounce that, Ross?
Gargouille. I can't pronounce it, though. Yeah. But I think it comes backwards, of course, into Latin.
Yeah.
Gargulio. Yeah. Gargola. Yes.
Which means gargle.
Gargle. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Next is zucchini or jacuzzi. We pick two. I like that juxtaposition.
That's
We're both really
great.
Happy with that.
That's
one.
Great. I mean, it's wow. So in this case, you've got somebody grew something and named it after themselves or their friend, and you've got somebody made a product and named it after themselves. I want to say zucchini because I like that better as a person's name, but jacuzzi easily could be a name, although it sounds like a made-up name. I'm going with zucchini.
Wrong. In this case, that was a good guess. Are you proud, Kat, that we put zucchini in? I'm so happy with that. But zucchini is a diminutive of zucca, which is gourd or squash, coming from Latin cucutia, which they have no idea where it came from.
Okay.
The jacuzzis were an immigrant Italian family of inventors, and they basically came to the States in 1915. Seven brothers had a company, and apparently back in Italy, the name was Jacuzzi, but they changed it to J because of Ellis Island or whatever. And it was interesting because they originally did aviation products, cabins for transporting mail and planes. But one of their brothers was killed in a plane crash, so they switched over to water pumps.
Wow.
And then they invented the hot tub for hydrotherapy.
Wow.
And they trademarked it. Isn't that cool?
Yes.
Well, I also like the fact that they invented it. It was one of the brothers, Candido, and it was because his son had rheumatic arthritis.
Yeah.
So it was like one of those things where he was trying to come up with something to help his son.
Yeah.
And the jacuzzi was born. Okay, next we're going to do clothing items.
Okay.
The two words are leotard or gabardine.
I don't have a good reason for either one, but I'm going to go with leotard. Gabardine sounds like it's descriptive of something, not named after a person.
Very good. Yeah, leotard was invented by the French acrobat Jules Leotard. In the 19th century so he could do his stuff on the trapeze and so forth. They were initially called maillots, which I knew was a one-piece bathing suit. Like in the 70s, that was a big thing, maillots coming from France. But then after Jules died, people started calling them leotards. And his name lives forever in the dance world, in the acrobatic world.
Fletcher, on this one, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you know what gabardine is?
No, I don't know what I don't know what gabard would be.
No, but I'm not saying that. Do you know what the term is?
No, I also don't know what that is. No.
No, because I don't either. Kath, I'm sure you knew it instantly, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I mean, I knew gabardine is some sort of fabric is what I knew only. Mm. That's all I would know. Is that with you, Fletcher, the same way?
No, if you had asked me what gabardine was, I would have said it was like some kind of adornment you put on a cake, or it was some kind of...
I was a little closer than you, but not
you
much.
You were, boss. No, it's a fabric, and it was, Burberry coats.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Burberry invented it. It was a weave. It's a very tight weave, and that's why like trench coats and stuff were made of gabardine.
Hmm.
I didn't know that Burberry part. That's interesting, too.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to move to one which has a little bit of a sad thing in it, but salmonella or tilapia. That's a good juxtaposition,
too. Wow. We've talked about salmonella, but I can't remember it sure doesn't feel like that had anything to do with a person. I guess I'll go with tilapia. I don't know where the name tilapia comes from, although I do suspect that it used to be called something else and it was rebranded. Tell me about tilapia.
Okay, tilapia comes from, you're wrong.
Okay.
It's salmonella,
it is salmonella.
First of all.
Okay.
Tilapia comes from 1849, formed in modern Latin, but possibly from the Greek, tilon, which is the name of a fish in Aristotle. And apios is distant, so it's distant fish because it's from Africa, and the guys who were naming it were in Europe.
Okay.
And salmonella.
This is sad.
I know. I felt so sorry for this when we read this. Salmonella comes, we're going to tell you, a pathologist, Theobald Smith, isolated the salmonella bacteria in pigs suffering from hog cholera.
That's not the sad part.
No. Well, for the pig it is, but whatever.
Yeah.
And Smith identified the bacteria for food poisoning, you know, which was that was causing the hog problem. But his limelight-grabbing supervisor, Daniel E. Salmon,
oh, wow,
insisted on taking the credit for the discovery, and it was named after him.
Oh, my gosh.
However, before we feel too sorry for Theobald, he apparently soon emerged from Salmon's shadow. And he went on to make an important discovery that ticks could be a vector in the spread of disease. So he got his name. So he did okay after all
Which
that.
Is why we talk about Lyme disease, because of Theobald Smith. Right.
Named after, yeah.
But he was apparently widely considered to be America's first internationally significant medical research scientist.
Oh, wow.
So he did okay.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that, actually. And he was the inspector of the Bureau of Animal Industry in the States. So he did okay.
Okay, finally, this is the last couplet. We're going out with a little musical fanfare. The two words are saxophone or castanet.
Well, I already know all about Adolf Sax, so I do know that.
Oh, okay,
saxophone.
That was we're ending with a thud.
No, yeah, I definitely saxophone is named after Adolf Sax, who invented a number of different instruments, but
Fletcher,
really the saxophone's the only one that took, I think.
Why do you know about Adolf Sax?
Well, a lot of reasons, but I used to play the saxophone, so.
Ah, oh,
well,
cool.
I wish we had known that, yeah.
Yeah, we would never. Did you know that his father invented the sax horn, which was not quite as popular?
Yes. Well, I didn't know it was his father. I thought it was the same guy who invented all of those things.
No, but now other places are saying that it was Adolf who
okay.
But let's move on.
Okay, Fletcher, we're going to talk about something that I'm sure you're constantly talking about over the dinner table. Phonotactics.
Oh, sure.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. The dinner table being the table that I set out with my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old, right? We talk about phonotactics all the time.
Mm-hmm. Never too early to start. Actually, though, it does really relate to your children, though, oddly enough. We're going to talk about rules that you know in English almost from the very beginning that you don't know, rules that you instinctively know, but that you don't know you know.
Oh,
okay?
Cool. Yeah, that you say that, that is what I see and hear every day from those kids. Is
you bet.
Is them following the rules or building around those rules and maybe sometimes breaking them, but you can see how they are forming those rules, you know, within their own language. Even though I never, of course, explicitly told them the rule.
Right. I don't think you did tell them, listen, son, phonotactically, you're wrong on pronunciation B. No. But we're going to do a little quiz for you now.
I've given him a list of 9 strings of sounds, Ross.
Good. And they're written in English orthography. I'll tell you how to pronounce them. Just read them off and we'll pronounce them. First, we're going to look at these sounds, okay?
And I'm just going to read these. Basically, they're collections of letters. These aren't actual words that would know.
And we're going to ask you to put them in order in a minute, in the order that you think sounds most like English. In effect, we're going to ask you,
boy.
Now, according to these rules that I know already, this sounds like it could be English. This sounds like it isn't English. We're talking about Lewis Carroll, 'twas brillig and the slithy toves, did gyre and gimble in the wave. Remember that?
Yeah.
And those were words that sounded kind of like they could be English. Okay.
Okay.
But start with just pronouncing.
Yeah. So I'm just going to say these. They're going to sound like nonsense, but I'm going to say these 7 sounds out loud. Okay.
Right.
Timp, rog, Mbato, Flesg, Spink, Be, Bod. And the last one, I guess you'd probably, I'm just going to say the sound as it, as the letters are there, Psore. It's P-S-O-R-E, so we, you know, if we saw it, we'd say sore probably, but.
Right, but it should be pronounced Psore in this case right now we're doing it. And then Flesg is written, I just wanted to say, because we can't see it, we can't, people aren't, they're not seeing the words as written. Mbato is M-B-O-T-T-O, and Flesg is F-L-E-Z-K, okay? Mm-hmm. And Beh was B-E-H.
Right.
Now.
Okay, now, now what Ross said is put them in order as to which sounds the most like a regular English word.
Okay.
To the least.
That you could reasonably say, oh, this could be incorporated into English easily and it could become a word. No problem.
Sure. By how they sound, not necessarily by how they look.
Well, how they look and sound. Just put them in order.
All right, I'll put them in order. Bod, and that one's easy because we already kind of say bod. So
right.
Bod, timp, spink, rog. Next would probably be be, then probably flesic,
okay,
mbato, and psore.
Fletcher, it's really
interesting. Wow.
We have the typical ranking. These linguists did they grabbed 40 English speakers and asked them to do a similar list.
Mm-hmm.
Bod was the clear winner, 4.66. Mm-hmm. Timp was next, 4.30. Mm-hmm. Rog was 4.2. Spink was 4.17.
Okay, so pretty close there on I had Rog and Spink switched, but that's pretty
close. But they're still so close that doesn't, you know.
And now in terms of ranking, we get a real problem. Suddenly the numbers collapse. Beh is 2.75.
Mm-hmm.
Psor is 2.02. Flesig is 1.69. And Bato averaged 1.07.
Yeah.
And that's where you were very different, because you had Beh, but they had Psor, Flesig, and Bato. You had Flesig, and Bato, Psor.
That's right. Well, I think Psor is just real weird. Ps, that ps, we don't have that really at the beginning of anything.
No.
I agree. I think Flesic is better than Psor, certainly.
Yeah.
This is a really weird conversation already. Psor. Well, that could be in Greek easily, though. Psor could be very easily. The PS is Greek. We already know it.
Sure, but we just don't say that.
No, we don't. And that's what we have to talk about quickly here, because I just said they're in Greek, but we're talking about English sounds.
Right.
We do take in these some of these sounds. Like Kathy mentioned, we were talking about this. What about czar? You know, TS or CZ, you know. Okay, that's fine, but those are foreign words into English.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the question we have now is, why do timp, rog, spink get higher scores than mbato?
Well, I mean, they don't have two consonants next to each other that we don't typically have at the beginning of words, especially.
You've got it. Those are phonotactic rules that you know without
being aware.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Without even knowing that there's a word like phonotactic.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. That's wild. Wow.
It's interesting because one of the articles we were looking at was using Scrabble as an example of how it works. And I must say, as an avid Scrabble player, my husband and I are addicted to Scrabble. It's true, because when you look at your letters, the first thing you do is start arranging them the way you think they would work.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you've got a G, N, I in there, you usually put ing down and see if you can do something with the other stuff. And we're playing Scrabble in Spanish now, and I'm having problems because I don't think in Spanish.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have that automatic, oh, these letters would be something.
Wow, that's really interesting, Kev, mm-hmm. Of course.
Yeah. It's just not an automatic thing where I go, oh, of course, these three letters.
Yeah,
DGE, for example.
You haven't absorbed the phonotactics of Spanish.
I have not.
So we're going to quickly go through a few rules, Fletcher. We're not going to go on and on. But basically, when you get these consonant sounds that we had in English and the vowel sounds in English, you have, I think it's 74,909,241,375 possible, basically 75 billion possible sounds.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And we know very well that we cannot repeat 75 billion sounds.
Well, I was going to say, I think we should ask Fletcher to attempt that right now, Ross.
That's a really good point, Kat. Okay, let's go through a couple of rules that you know, but you don't know you know them. The first phonotactic rule number one is all words must contain, phonological words must contain at least one syllable, and hence must contain at least one vowel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Kath, do you want to do phonotactic rule number two?
You know
phonotactic
what? You know what, though?
Rule number two, what?
I will tell you, sometimes you'll be doing a crossword puzzle, and then the answer will be TISK, T-S-K, right?
True.
But
or
the vowel sound is
H-M-M.
That's right. Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. But those aren't technically word words.
Yeah,
those are
onomatopoeia, right.
Which are sounds.
Yeah,
they're not. Okay. So they don't violate phonotactic rule number one.
Now, phonotactic rule number two, sequences of repeated consonants, i.e. more than two consonants, are not possible. You don't have S-S-S-S-S in a word.
Except for snakes.
Thank you, Ross. But you have his, H-I-S-S, but you do not have his, H-I-S-S-S.
Right, so not more than two of the same consonant back to back.
Right.
Repeated,
yeah.
Correct.
Okay, so now using these two phonotactic rules, we're down to only 60 billion possible sounds.
Get out of there.
Okay, now Fletcher, I'm sure this is going to jump in. I'm sure this already jumped into your head. The velar nasal never occurs at the onset of a syllable. You know that is phonotactic rule number three, I'm sure.
Of course, absolutely. Moving on.
Okay, yeah. Okay, but that translates into regular English, which you do know this rule. No NGs as an ing at the beginning of a word.
Oh, in English words, yeah. That's true.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you immediately think of Vietnamese.
Of course. Right.
Yeah. Which isn't pronounced like that either, which is weird, but we won't go there. I'm not
right.
quite
we
sure
don't
that.
Need to. Yeah. Yeah. Phonotactic rule number four, similar, but the end. No H's are pronounced at the end of the word.
Yeah.
Or as Ross would have said, the glottal fricative H never occurs in the coda of a syllable.
Oh,
I say that all the time.
Yes.
And I'm sure Fletcher's kids talk about this at dinner, no?
Yes, no.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Syllabic codas are very, very important.
No, but it's like, so you do have an H at the end of the word, like ba or, you know, huh, but you don't pronounce it like you do
right.
in hut
mm-hmm.
or,
right.
or hat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to do another couple of phonotactic rules before we all die, but we have a lot. No TS's or DZ's starting a word. You mentioned TISK, but TISK really isn't the TS sound. It's really, it's written that way, but it's
yeah.
really T-I-S-K is
yep.
pronounced. Yeah. Yep. It's not SITHK like
yeah.
that. We can't do it.
Yeah. And the TS you mentioned with czar, but of course that's not an English word.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Catherine, do you want to chuck in phonotactic rule next one?
The first consonant, when you have two consonants like the C sound and CL, clock, or the B sound in BL, it's called an obstruent. It obstructs airflow. So you hear it bluh, kluh, like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the rule? Must be an obstruent.
Oh, it must
yeah.
be an obstruent.
Yeah.
I didn't say the must.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
said it is an obstruent. Sorry.
No.
I was busy going bluh and kluh.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that one.
An obstruent?
Yeah, it's not totally clear to me. I mean, I understand the blocking sound thing, but...
Well, try to just pronounce buh.
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 Kuh. Okay, obstruents, they're contrast with sonorants, which have, they resonate. They go kind of right through. Sonorants can be vowels as well as consonants. Obstruents would be like plosives, which are oral stops like puh and buh, and like you're closing your vocal tract. Or it can be fricatives with limited closure like suh and zuh, slightly
okay.
cuffed.
So you're saying... It has to be the obstruction one if you've got two consonants at the beginning?
Mm-hmm. If you have two consonants, the first one has to be yes.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you're going with P, B, S, Z, etc. Z sounds.
K, clock, blow.
Good, now we're down to 28 million.
Okay.
Sounds.
These are getting harder for me to totally wrap my head around.
They get very complicated.
But the bottom line is, after we go through all of these, glides, fricatives, etc., we get down to literally only 6,600,000 possible combinations.
Yeah.
That's a lot, but that's a lot less than whatever.
75
billion.
90 billion, yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. It's incredible.
75 billion, yeah.
And the most interesting part of this whole thing, we could go on, there are literally a bunch more phonotactic rules with all this's and that's, and I don't think we need to go into it. It's not even that important. The key thing is, in your head, you and everyone else they surveyed basically put these words in roughly the same order. I mean, we could argue is psor and ambato, you know, which is, but the key thing is you guys, both, all of you got the whole idea.
Yeah.
Certain words we had, like, you know, certain words that are obviously Englishy and they sound okay. And then certain words that are obviously not Englishy and they sound awful. Mm-hmm. They don't sound like they're English. And we all know this.
Without knowing that we know.
Without knowing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like you said, we are all going to put those in roughly the same order. Once we get down to the ones that really don't have any relation to English sounds, that's when things are really going to probably start switching around for people. Because, I mean, you're just kind of picking at that
point. Yeah, you're just guessing. Yeah. Which was,
it's like what you feel more comfortable with for some reason. Yeah. Like you didn't feel comfortable with psor.
Right.
Yeah.
So a question I have that you may not know the answer to, do you know what language has the most possible sounds and what has the fewest?
Well, as Kathy talks, I'm looking it up.
So I'm already typing wrong.
Yes, the Ta language.
Formerly called Southern Kwasan. Yeah, it's in Botswana and Namibia.
It's highest sound inventory. But we don't really know that, because that's like the sound inventory that they have with words that they already have. We're talking here about possible sound inventory. So I'm not really sure that's even correct, Kath.
The language generally recognized by linguists with the smallest sound inventory is Rotakis, a Papuan language spoken in Papua New Guinea.
Oh,
of course. Only 11 phonemes, 6 consonants, and 5 vowels.
Oh, we should have known that, of course. Yeah. What am I talking about? Of course.
Silly you, Ross.
But the one issue, going back to the one issue that really gets me the most about this is that right now, at your dinner table, your young children know probably most of these rules already. And isn't that incredible, really?
Yeah, it really is. It really, really is.
You could talk about plosives and all that, and they'll have no idea, but they know the rules.
Even when they're making up words. And I mean, of course, kids that age make up words because kids that age make up everything. But even when they're making up words, they're not making up psor.
No.
No, they're not.
They know the rules already. And that interested me just recently. There was this article done, which it's a long time they've known it, but I didn't really think about it. Like, when you tell your kid, like, you see a rabbit hopping down the street, and you go, look, a rabbit. Look, a rabbit's hopping. Look at that. We used to think a long time ago that in his little head, he thinks, rabbit, R-A-B, you know, not the sound rabbit, and he connects it with the animal. But they've now discovered that there's far more complexity in even a little child. You're saying hopping, and then he hears that ing and is thinking automatically, progressive tense, not obviously that word.
Right.
But that means something is doing something. Then he's taking that and parsing the whole thing and going, look is basically a command telling me to look at something. I'm figuring that out. And then in there, in between there is something called rabbit, which is probably the thing that's doing the ing thing. And then the ing thing is probably hopping because it looks like it's going up and down. All of that huge complexity
is
entering into a young child's head so that they get it. And then we've seen that we talked about this a while back, even with a child learning eventually the ED means past tense generally. And then learning the word, I went to the store, which is much more, which is possibly earlier, and then correcting incorrectly saying I go to the store.
Right.
Because they've now learned the ED tends to be. And I mean, it's really weird that we can get all that in our heads, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just incredible.
So for next week, Fletcher, we're going to give you, you can go through the next Phonotactic 10 rules and then explain them.
And start working on that list of, what was it?
75 billion sounds? I'll have that back to you next time, I'm sure.
Thank you.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. Our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. Carly Cooper is also our video editor. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org, or email them at kandrpetris@gmail.com. You can also record a voice memo of yourself asking your question. You might get your voice heard on air. Or you can download the KMUW app and press the Talk to Us button. You can find Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.